An end to the strike is worth a lot of money to you. Yes. So the Coalheavers' riot will make money for you. It might stop my family losing money. Is that why you cooperated with Sidney Lennox in provoking the riot? Mac turned away. I did no such thing, said Jay, but he was speaking to the back of Mac's head. Gordonson said, You should be a lawyer, Mac. Where did you learn to argue like that? Mrs. Wheel's parlour, he replied. Gordonson was mystified. Pym had no more witnesses. The sceptical juror said, Aren't we going to hear from this Lennox character? The Crown has no more witnesses, Pym repeated. Well, I think we should hear from him. He seems to be behind it all. Jurors cannot call witnesses, the judge said. Mac called his first, an Irish coalheaver known as Red Michael for the colour of his hair. Red told how Mac had been on the point of persuading the coalheavers to go home when they were attacked. When he had finished, the judge said, And what work do you do, young man? I'm a coalheaver, sir, Red replied. The judge said, The jury will take that into account when considering whether to believe you or not. Mac's heart sank. The judge was doing all he could to prejudice the jury against him. He called his next witness, but he was another coalheaver and suffered the same fate. The third and last was also a coalheaver. That was because they had been in the thick of things and had seen exactly what happened. His witnesses had been destroyed. Now there was only himself and his own character and eloquence. "Coalheaving is hard work, cruelly hard," he began. "Only strong young men can do it. But it's highly paid. In my first week I earned £6. I earned it, but I did not receive it. Most was stolen from me by an undertaker." The judge interrupted him. "This has nothing to do with the case," he said. "The charge is riot." "I didn't riot," Mac said. He took a deep breath and gathered his thoughts, then went on. "I simply refused to let undertakers steal my wages. That's my crime. Undertakers get rich by stealing from coalheavers. But when the coalheavers decided to do their own undertaking, what happened? They were boycotted by the shippers. And who are the shippers, gentlemen? The Jamieson family, which is so inextricably involved in this trial today." The judge said irritably, "Can you prove that you did not riot?" The sceptical juror interjected, "The point is that the fighting was instigated by others." Mac was not put off by the interruption. He simply continued with what he wanted to say. "Gentlemen of the jury, ask yourselves some questions." He turned away from the jurors and looked straight at Jay. "Who ordered that wagons of coal should be brought down Wapping High Street at an hour when the taverns are full of coalheavers? Who sent them to the very coalyard where I live? Who paid the men who escorted the wagons?" The judge was trying to break in again, but Mac raised his voice and ploughed on. "Who gave them muskets and ammunition? Who made sure the troops were standing by in the immediate neighbourhood? Who orchestrated the entire riot?" He swung around swiftly and looked at the jury. "You know the answer, don't you?" He held their gaze a moment longer, then turned away. He felt shaky. He had done his best, and now his life was in the hands of others. Gordonson got to his feet.
"We were expecting a character witness to appear on McCash's behalf, the Reverend Mr. York, pastor of the church in the village of his birth, but he has not yet arrived."
Mac was not very disappointed about York, for he did not expect York's testimony to have much effect, and nor did Gordonson. The judge said, "If he arrives, he may speak before sentencing." Gordonson raised his eyebrows, and the judge added, "That is, unless the jury finds the defendant not guilty, in which case further testimony would be superfluous, needless to say. Gentlemen, consider your verdict." Mac studied the jurors fearfully as they conferred. He thought, to his dismay, that they looked unsympathetic. Perhaps he had come on too strong.
"What do you think?" he said to Gordonson.
The lawyer shook his head.
"They'll find it hard to believe that the Jamieson family entered into a shabby conspiracy with Sidney Lennox. You might have done better to present the coalheavers as well-intentioned, but misguided."
"I told the truth," Mac said. "I can't help it."
Gordonson smiled sadly.
"If you weren't that kind of man, you might not be in so much trouble." The jurors were arguing.
"What the devil are they talking about?" Max said. "I wish we could hear."
He could see the skeptical one making a point forcefully, wagging his finger. Were the others listening attentively, or ranged against him?
"Be grateful," Gordonson said. "The longer they talk, the better for you." "Why?" "If they're arguing, there must be doubt. And if there is doubt, they have to find you not guilty."
Mac watched fearfully. The skeptical one shrugged and half turned away, and Mac feared he had lost the argument. The foreman said something to him, and he nodded. The foreman approached the bench. The judge said, "Have you reached a verdict?" "We have." Mac held his breath. "And how do you find the prisoner?" "We find him guilty as charged." Lady Hallam said,
"Your feeling for this minor is rather strange, my dear. A husband might find it objectionable." "Oh, Mother, don't be ridiculous."
There was a knock at the dining-room door, and a footman came in.
"The Reverend Mr. York, madam," he said. "What a lovely surprise," said Mother.
She had always been fond of York. In a low voice she added,
"His wife died, Lizzie, did I tell you, leaving him with 3 children. "But what's he doing here?"
Lizzie said anxiously.
"He's supposed to be at the Old Bailey. Show him in quickly."
The pastor came in, looking as if he had dressed hastily. Before Lizzie could ask him why he was not at the trial, he said something that momentarily took her mind off Mac.
"Lady Hallam, Mrs. Jamieson, I arrived in London a few hours ago, and I've called on you at the earliest possible moment to offer you both my sympathies. What a dreadful—"
Lizzie's mother said, "No!" then clamped her lips tight.
"Dreadful blow to you."
Lizzie shot a puzzled look at her mother and said,
"What are you talking about, Mr. York?" "The Pitt disaster, of course." "I don't know anything about it, although I see my mother does." "My goodness, I'm terribly sorry to have shocked you. There was a roof collapse at your pit and 20 people were killed."
Lizzie gasped.
"How absolutely dreadful."
In her mind she saw 20 new graves in the little churchyard by the bridge. There would be so much grief. Everyone in the neighbourhood would be mourning someone. But something else worried her.
"What do you mean when you say your pit? Hyde Glen?"
Lizzie went cold.
"There is no pit at Hyde Glen. Only the new one, of course. The one that was begun when you married Mr. Jamieson."
Lizzie felt frozen with rage. She rounded on her mother.
"You knew, didn't you?"
Lady Hallam had the grace to look ashamed.
"My dear, it was the only thing to do. That's why Sir George gave you the Virginia property." "You betrayed me,"
Lizzie cried.
"You all deceived me, even my husband. How could you? How could you lie to me?"
Her mother began to cry.
"We thought you'd never know. You're going to America."
Her tears did nothing to blunt Lizzie's outrage.
"You thought I'd never know? I can hardly believe my ears. Don't do anything rash, I beg you."
An awful thought struck Lizzie. She turned to the pastor.
"Mac's twin sister. I'm afraid Esther McCash was among the dead," he said. "Oh, no."
Mac and Esther were the first twins Lizzie had ever seen, and she had been fascinated by them. As children, they were hard to tell apart until you got to know them. In later life, Esther looked like a female Mac, with the same striking green eyes and the miner's squat muscularity. Lizzie remembered them a few short months ago, standing side by side outside the church. Esther had told Mac to shut his gob, and that had made Lizzie laugh. Now Esther was dead, and Mac was about to be condemned to death. Remembering Mac, she said,
"The trial is today." York said, "Oh, my goodness, I didn't know it was so soon. Am I too late?" "Perhaps not if you go now." "I will. How far is it?" 15 minutes walk, 5 minutes in a sedan chair. I'm coming with you."
Mother said, "No, please." Lizzie made her voice harsh. "Don't try to stop me, Mother. I'm going to plead for Mac's life myself. We killed the sister. Perhaps we can save the brother."
"I'm coming with you," said Lady Hallam.
The Sessions Yard was crammed with people. Lizzie was confused and lost, and neither York nor her mother was any help. She pushed through the crowd, searching for Gordonson or Mac. She came to a low wall that enclosed an inner yard and at last saw Mac and Caspar Gordonson through the railings. When she called, Gordonson came out through a gate. At the same time, Sir George and Jay appeared. Jay said in a reproving tone, "Lizzie, why are you here?" She ignored him and spoke to Gordonson.
"This is the Reverend Mr. York from our village in Scotland. He's come to plead for Mac's life."
Sir George wagged a finger at York. "If you've got any sense, you'll turn around and go straight back to Scotland."
Lizzie said, "And I'm going to plead for his life, too." "Thank you," Gordonson said fervently. "It's the best thing you could possibly do."
Lady Hallam said,
"I tried to stop her, Sir George."
Jay flushed with anger and grabbed Lizzie by the arm, squeezing hard.
"How dare you humiliate me like this?" he spat. "I absolutely forbid you to speak."
"Are you intimidating this witness?" said Gordonson.
Jay looked cowed and let go. A lawyer with a bundle of papers pushed through the middle of their little group. Jay said,
"Do we have to have this discussion here, where the whole world can see?"
"Yes," said Gordonson. "We can't leave the court."
Sir George said to Lizzie, "What the devil do you mean by this, my girl?" The arrogant tone maddened Lizzie.
"You know damn well what I mean by it," she said.
The men were all startled to hear her swear, and two or three people standing nearby turned and looked at her. She ignored their reactions.
"You all planned this riot to trap Macash. I'm not going to stand by and see you hang him."
Sir George reddened. "Remember that you're my daughter-in-law and..."
"Shut up, George," she interrupted. "I won't be bullied."
He was thunderstruck. No one had ever told him to shut up, she was sure. Jay took up the cudgels.
"You can't go against your own husband," he stormed. "It's disloyal."
"Disloyal?" she repeated scornfully. "Who the hell are you to talk to me about loyalty? You swore to me that you would not mine coal on my land, then went ahead and did exactly that. You betrayed me on our wedding day."
They all went quiet, and for a moment Lizzie could hear a witness giving evidence loudly on the other side of the wall.
"You know about the accident, then?" said Jay.
She took a deep breath. "I might as well say now that Jay and I will be leading separate lives from today. We'll be married in name only. I shall return to my house in Scotland, and none of the Jamieson family will be welcomed there. As for my speaking up for Macash, I'm not going to help you hang my friend, and you can both
kiss my arse."
Sir George was too stupefied to say anything. No one had spoken to him this way for years. He was beetroot red, his eyes bulged, and he spluttered, but no words came out. Caspar Gordonson addressed Jay.
"May I make a suggestion?"
Jay gave him a hostile glare, but said curtly, go on.
"Mrs. Jamieson might be persuaded not to testify on one condition."
"What?"
"You, Jay, should plead for Mac's life."
"Absolutely not," said Jay. Gordonson went on,
"It would be just as effective, but it would save the family the embarrassment of a wife going against her husband in open court."
He suddenly looked sly.
"Instead, you would look magnanimous. You could say that Mac was a miner in the Jamieson pits, and for that reason the family wishes to be merciful."
Lizzie's heart leaped with hope. A plea for mercy from Jay, the officer who had quelled the riot, would be much more effective. She could see hesitation flicker across Jay's face as he weighed the consequences. Then he said sulkily,
"I suppose I have to accept this."
Before Lizzie had time to feel exultant, Sir George intervened.
"There's one condition which I know Jay will insist upon."
Lizzie had a bad feeling that she knew what was coming. Sir George looked at her.
"You must forget all this nonsense about separate lives. You are to be a proper wife to Jay in every way."
"No," she cried. "He has betrayed me. How can I trust him? I won't do it."
Sir George said, "Then Jay will not plead for Macash's life."
Gordonson said,
"I must tell you, Lizzie, that Jay's plea will be more effective than yours, because he's the prosecutor."
Lizzie felt bewildered. It was not fair. She was being forced to choose between Mac's life and her own. How could she decide such a thing? She was pulled both ways, and it hurt. They were all staring at her, Jay, Sir George, Gordonson, her mother, and York. She knew she should give in, but something inside would not let her.
"No," she said defiantly, "I will not trade my own life for Max."
Gordonson said, "Think again."
Then her mother said,
"You have to."
Lizzie looked at her. Of course her mother would urge her to do the conventional thing. But mother was on the verge of tears.
"What is it?"
She began to cry.
"You have to be a proper wife to Jay."
"Why?" because you're going to have a baby.
Lizzie stared at her.
What? What are you talking about?
You're pregnant,
her mother said.
How would you know?
Mother spoke through sobs.
Your bosom has got bigger, and food makes you feel sick. You've been married for 2 months. It's not exactly unexpected.
Oh, my God.
Lizzie was dumbfounded. Everything was turned upside down.
A baby? Could it be?
She thought back and realized she had not had the curse since her wedding day. So it was true. She was trapped by her own body. Jay was the father of her child. And Mother had realized this was the one thing that could change Lizzie's mind. She looked at her husband. On his face she saw anger mixed with a pleading look.
"Why did you lie to me?" she said.
"I didn't want to, but I had to," he said.
She felt bitter. Her love for him would never be quite the same, she knew. But he was still her husband.
"All right," she said. "I accept,"
Caspar Gordonson said.
"Then we're all in agreement."
It sounded to Lizzie like a life sentence.
"Oh, yes! Oh, yes! Oh, yes!" shouted the court crier. "My lords, the king's justices, strictly command all manner of persons to keep silence while the sentence of death is passing on the prisoners at the bar on pain of imprisonment."
The judge put on his black cap and stood up. Mac shuddered with loathing. 19 cases had been tried on the same day, and 12 people had been found guilty. Mac suffered a wave of terror. Lizzie had forced Jay to plead for mercy, which meant that his death sentence should be reprieved. But what if the judge decided to discount Jay's plea, or just made a mistake? Lizzie was at the back of the court. Mac caught her eye. She looked pale and shaken. He had not had a chance to speak to her. She tried to give him an encouraging smile, but it turned into a grimace of fear. The judge looked at the 12 prisoners standing in a line, and after a moment he spoke.
"The law is that thou shalt return from hence to the place whence thou camest, and from thence to the place of execution, where thou shalt hang by the neck till the body be dead, dead, dead. And the Lord have mercy on thy soul."
There was an awful pause. Cora held Mac's arm, and he felt her fingers digging into his flesh as she suffered the same dreadful anxiety. The other prisoners had little hope of pardon. As they heard their death sentences, some screamed abuse, some wept, and one prayed loudly.
"Peg Knapp is reprieved and recommended for transportation," the judge intoned. "Cora Higgins is reprieved and recommended for transportation. Malachi McCash is reprieved and recommended for transportation. The rest are left to hang."
Mac put his arms around Cora and Peg, and the three of them stood in a mutual embrace. Their lives had been spared. Caspar Gordonson joined in the embrace. Then he took Mac's arm and said solemnly,
"I have to give you some dreadful news."
Mac was scared again. Would their reprieve somehow be overturned?
"There has been a roof collapse in one of the Jamison pits," he went on.
Mac's heart missed a beat. He dreaded what was coming.
20 people were killed,"
Gordonson said. "Esther?"
"I'm sorry, Mac. Your sister was among the dead." "Dead?"
It was hard to take in. Life and death had been dealt out like cards today.
"Esther, dead. How could he not have a twin?
He had always had her since he was born."
"I should have let her come with me,"
he said as his eyes filled with tears.
"Why did I leave her behind?"
Peg stared at him wide-eyed. Cora held his hand and said,
"A life saved and a life lost."
Mac put his hands over his face and wept. End of side 12. Side 13.
Chapter 25. The day of departure came quickly. One morning, without warning, all the prisoners who had been sentenced to transportation were told to pick up their possessions and herded into the courtyard. Mac had few possessions. Other than his clothes, there was just his Robinson Crusoe, the broken iron collar he had brought from Hugh, and the fur cloak Lizzie had given him. In the courtyard, a blacksmith shackled them in pairs with heavy leg irons. Mac was humiliated by the fetters. The feel of the cold iron on his ankle brought him very low. He had fought for his freedom and lost the battle, and once again he was in chains like an animal. He hoped the ship would sink and he would drown. Males and females were not allowed to be chained together. Mac was paired with a filthy old drunk called Mad Barney. Cora made eyes at the blacksmith and got herself paired with Peg.
"I don't believe Caspar knows we're leaving today," Mac said worriedly. "Perhaps they don't have to notify anyone."
He looked up and down the line of convicts. There were more than 100, he reckoned, around a quarter of them female, with a sprinkling of children from about 9 years upwards. Among the men was Sidney Lennox. Lennox's fall had caused much glee. No one would trust him since he gave evidence against Peg. The thieves who had disposed of their stolen goods at the Sun Tavern now went elsewhere. And although the coal heavers' strike had been broken and most of the men were back at work, no one would work for Lennox at any price. He had tried to coerce a woman called Gwen Sixpence into stealing for him, but she and two friends had informed against him for receiving stolen property, and he had duly been convicted. The Jamesons had intervened and saved him from the gallows, but they could not prevent his being transported. The great wooden doors of the prison swung wide. A squad of 8 guards stood outside to escort them. A jailer gave a violent shove to the pair at the front of the line, and slowly they moved out into the busy city street.
"We're not far from Fleet Street," Mac said. "It's possible Caspar may get to know of this." "What difference does it make?" said Cora. "He can bribe the ship's captain to give us special treatment."
Mac had learned a little about crossing the Atlantic by questioning prisoners, guards, and visitors in Newgate. The one indubitable fact he had learned was that the voyage killed many people. Whether the passengers were slaves, convicts, or indentured servants, conditions below decks were lethally unhealthy. Shippers were motivated by money. They crammed as many people as possible into their holds. But captains were mercenary too, and a prisoner with cash for bribes could travel in a cabin. Londoners stopped what they were doing to watch the convicts make their last shameful progress through the heart of the city. Some shouted condolences, some jeered and mocked, and a few threw stones or rubbish. Mac asked a friendly-looking woman to take a message to Caspar Gordonson, but she refused. He tried again, twice, with the same result. The iron slowed them down, and it took more than an hour to shuffle to the waterfront. The river was busy with ships, barges, ferries, and rafts, for the strikes were over, crushed by the troops. It was a warm spring morning. Sunlight glinted off the muddy Thames. A boat was waiting to take them out to their ship, which was anchored in midstream. Mac read its name.
"The Rosebud." "Is it a Jamieson ship?" said Cora. "I think most of the convict ships are."
As he stepped from the muddy foreshore into the boat, Mac realized this would be the last time he stood on British soil for many years, perhaps forever. He had mixed feelings. Fear and apprehension mingled with a certain reckless excitement at the prospect of a new country and a new life. Boarding the ship was difficult. They had to climb the ladder in pairs with the leg irons on. Peg and Cora managed easily enough, being young and nimble, but Mac had to carry Barney. One pair of men fell into the river. Neither the guards nor the sailors did anything to help them, and they would have drowned if the other prisoners had not reached out and pulled them back into the boat. The ship was about 40 feet long by 15 wide. Peg commented,
"I've burgled drawing rooms that were bigger than this, by Christ."
On deck were hens in a coop, a small pigsty, and a tethered goat. On the other side of the ship, a magnificent white horse was being hoisted out of a boat with the help of the yardarm used as a crane. A scrawny cat bared its fangs at Mac. He had an impression of coiled ropes and furled sails, a smell of varnish, and a rocking motion underfoot. Then they were shoved across the lip of a hatch and down a ladder. There seemed to be 3 lower decks. On the first, 4 sailors were eating their midday meal, sitting cross-legged on the floor, surrounded by sacks and chests that presumably contained supplies for the voyage. On the third, all the way down at the foot of the ladder, 2 men were stacking barrels, hammering wedges between them, so that they could not move during the voyage. At the level of the middle deck, which was obviously for the convicts, a sailor roughly pulled Mac and Barney off the ladder and shoved them through a doorway. There was an odor of tar and vinegar. Mac peered at his surroundings in the gloom. The ceiling was an inch or two above his head. A tall man would have to stoop. It was pierced by two gratings, which admitted a little light and air, not from outside, but from the enclosed deck above, which itself was lit by open hatches. Along both sides of the hold were wooden racks, 6 feet wide, one at waist height, and one a few inches off the floor. With horror, Mac realized the racks were for the convicts to lie on. They would be spending the voyage on these bare shelves. They shuffled along the narrow walkway between the rows. The first few berths were already occupied by convicts lying flat, still chained in pairs. They were quiet, stunned by what was happening to them. A sailor directed Peg and Cora to lie next to Mac and Barney, like knives in a drawer. They took their positions, and the sailor roughly shoved them closer together so that they were touching. Peg was able to sit upright, but the grown-ups were not, for there was not enough headroom. The best Mac could do was to prop himself on one elbow. At the end of the row, Mac spotted a large earthenware jar, about 2 feet high, cone-shaped, with a broad flat base and a rim about 9 inches across. There were three others around the hold. They were the only items of furniture visible, and he realized they were the toilets.
"How long will it take to get to Virginia?"
said Peg.
7 weeks, he said, "if we're lucky."
Lizzie watched as her trunk was carried into the large cabin at the rear of the Rosebud. She and Jay had the owner's quarters, a bedroom and a day room, and there was more space than she had expected. Everyone talked of the horrors of the transatlantic voyage, but she was determined to make the best of it and try to enjoy the novel experience. Making the best of things was now her philosophy of life. She could not forget Jay's betrayal. She still clenched her fists and bit her lip every time she thought of the hollow promise he had made on their wedding day. But she tried always to push it to the back of her mind. Only a few weeks ago she would have been thrilled by this trip. Going to America was her great ambition. It was one of the reasons she had married Jay. She had anticipated a new life in the colonies, a more free and easy outdoor existence, without petticoats or calling cards, where a woman could get dirt under her fingernails and speak her mind like a man. But the dream had lost some of its glow when she learned of the deal Jay had made. They ought to call the plantation 20 Graves, she thought moodily. She tried to pretend that Jay was as dear to her as ever, but her body told the truth. When he touched her at night, she did not respond as she once had. She would kiss and caress him, but his fingers did not scorch her skin, and his tongue no longer seemed to reach all the way inside to touch her soul. Once upon a time, the mere sight of him had made her moist between the legs. Now she surreptitiously oiled herself with cold cream before getting into bed, otherwise intercourse hurt her. He always ended up groaning and gasping with pleasure as he spilled his seed inside her, but there was no such culmination for her. Instead, she was left with an unfulfilled feeling. Later, when she heard him snoring, she would console herself with her fingers, and then her head would fill with strange images, men wrestling and whores with exposed breasts. But her life was dominated by thoughts of the baby. Her pregnancy made her disappointments seem less important. She would love her baby without reservation. The child would become her life's work, and he or she would grow up a Virginian. As she was taking off her hat, there was a tap at the cabin door. A wiry man in a blue coat and a three-cornered hat stepped inside and bowed.
"Silas Bone, first mate, at your service, Mrs. Jamison, Mr. Jamison," he said.
"Good day to you, Bone," Jay said stiffly, assuming the dignity of the owner's son.
"Captain's compliments to you both," Bone said.
They had already met Captain Parridge, a dour, aloof Kentish man from Rochester.
"We'll get underway at the turn of the tide," Bone went on.
He gave Lizzie a patronizing smile.
"However, we'll be within the Thames estuary for the first day or so, so madam need not worry about bumpy weather just yet."
Jay said, "Are my horses on board?"
"Yes, sir."
"Let's have a look at their accommodation."
"Certainly. Perhaps Mrs. J will stay and unpack her little bits and pieces."
Lizzie said, "I'll come with you. I'd like to take a look around."
Bone said, "You'll find it best to stay in your cabin as much as possible on the voyage, Mrs. J. Sailors are rough folk, and the weather is rougher."
Lizzie bridled. "I have no intention of spending the next 7 weeks cooped up in this little room," she snapped.
"Lead the way, Mr. Bone."
"Aye, aye, Mrs. J."
They stepped out of the cabin and walked along the deck to an open hatch. The mate scampered down a ladder, agile as a monkey. Jay went after him, and Lizzie followed. They went to the second of the lower decks. Daylight filtered down from the open hatch, and it was augmented a little by a single lamp on a hook. Jay's favourite horses, the two greys, and the birthday present, Blizzard, stood in narrow stalls. Each had a sling under its belly, attached to a beam overhead, so that if it lost its footing in heavy seas, it could not fall. There was hay in a manger at the horses' heads, and the deck below them was sanded to protect their hooves. They were valuable beasts, and would be hard to replace in America. They were nervous, and Jay petted them for a while, speaking to them soothingly. Lizzie became impatient and wandered along the deck to where a heavy door stood open. Bone followed her.
"I wouldn't wander around if I were you, Mrs. Jay," he said. "You might see things that would distress you."
She ignored him and went forward. She was not squeamish.
"That's the convict hold ahead," he said. "It's no place for a lady."
He had said the magic words that guaranteed she would persist. She turned around and fixed him with a look.
"Mr. Bone, this ship belongs to my father-in-law, and I will go where I like. Is that clear?"
"Aye, aye, Mrs. J."
"And you can call me Mrs. Jamieson."
"Aye, aye, Mrs. Jamieson."
She was keen to see the convict hole because McCash might be there. This was the first convict ship to leave London since his trial. She went forward a couple of paces, ducked her head under a beam, pushed open a door, and found herself in the main hold. It was warm, and there was an oppressive stink of crowded humanity. She stared into the gloom. At first she could see nobody, although she heard the murmur of many voices. She was in a big space filled with what looked like storage racks for barrels. Something moved on the shelf beside her, with a clank like a chain, and she jumped. Then she saw, to her horror, that what had moved was a human foot in an iron clamp. There was someone lying on the shelf, she saw. No, two people, fettered together at their ankles. As her eyes adjusted, she saw another couple lying shoulder to shoulder with the first, then another, and she realized there were dozens of them, packed together on those racks like herrings in a fishmonger's tray. Surely, she thought, this was just temporary accommodation, and they would be given proper bunks at least for the voyage. Then she realized what a foolish notion that was. Where could such bunks be? This was the main hold, occupying most of the space below deck. There was nowhere else for these wretched people to go. They would spend at least 7 weeks lying here in the airless gloom.
"Lizzie Jamieson," said a voice.
She gave a start. She recognized the Scots accent. It was Mac. She peered into the dark, saying,
"Mac, where are you?"
"Here."
She took a few paces along the narrow walkway between the racks. An arm was stretched out to her, ghostly grey in the twilight. She squeezed Mac's hard hand.
"This is dreadful," she said. "What can I do?"
"Nothing now," he said.
She saw Cora lying beside him and the child Peg next to her. At least they were all together. Something in Cora's expression made Lizzie let go of Mac's hand.
"Perhaps I can make sure you get enough food and water," she said.
"That would be kind."
Lizzie could not think of anything else to say. She stood there in silence for a few moments.
"I'll come back down here every day if I can," she said at last.
"Thank you."
She turned and hurried out. She retraced her steps with an indignant protest on her lips, but when she caught the eye of Silas Bone, she saw such a look of scorn on his face that she bit back her words. The convicts were on board and the ship was about to set sail, and nothing she could say would change matters now. A protest would only vindicate Bone's warning that women should not go below decks.
"The horses are comfortably settled," Jay said with an air of satisfaction. Lizzie could not resist a retort.
"They're better off than the human beings."
"Ah, that reminds me," said Jay. "Bone, there's a convict in the hold called Sidney Lennox. Have his irons struck and put him in a cabin, please."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Why is Lennox with us?"
Lizzie said aghast.
"He was convicted of receiving stolen goods, but the family has made use of him in the past, and we can't abandon him. He might die in the hold."
"Oh, Jay,"
Lizzie cried in dismay,
"he's such a bad man."
"On the contrary, he's quite useful."
Lizzie turned away. She had rejoiced to be leaving Lennox behind in England. What bad luck that he too had been transported.
Would Jay never escape from his malign influence?
Bone said, "The tide's on the turn, Mr. Jamieson. Captain will be impatient to weigh anchor."
"My compliments to the captain and tell him to carry on."
They all climbed the ladder. A few minutes later, Lizzie and Jay stood in the bows as the ship began to move downriver on the tide. A fresh evening breeze buffeted Lizzie's cheeks. As the dome of St. Paul's slipped below the skyline of warehouses, she said,
"I wonder if we'll ever see London again."
Part 3. Virginia. Chapter 26. Mac lay in the hold of the Rosebud, shaking with fever. He felt like an animal, filthy, nearly naked, chained and helpless. He could hardly stand upright, but his mind was clear enough. He vowed he would never again allow anyone to put iron fetters on him. He would fight, try to escape, and hope they killed him rather than suffer this degradation again. An excited cry from on deck penetrated the hold.
"Soundings at 35 fathoms, Captain! Sand and reeds!"
A cheer went up from the crew. Peg said,
"What's a fathom?"
6 feet of water," Mac said with weary relief. "It means we're approaching land."
He had often felt he would not make it. 25 of the prisoners had died at sea. They had not starved. It seemed that Lizzie, who had not reappeared below decks, had nevertheless kept her promise and ensured they had enough to eat and drink. But the drinking water had been foul, and the diet of salt, meat and bread unhealthily monotonous, and all the convicts had been violently ill with the type of sickness that was sometimes called hospital fever and sometimes jail fever. Mad Barney had been the first to die of it. The old went quickest. Disease was not the only cause of death. 5 people had been killed in one dreadful storm when the prisoners had been tossed around the hold, helplessly injuring themselves and others with their iron chains. Peg had always been thin, but now she looked as if she was made of sticks. Cora had aged. Even in the half-dark of the hold, Mac could see that her hair was falling out, her face drawn, and her once voluptuous body was scraggy and disfigured with sores. Mac was just glad they were still alive. Sometime later, he heard another sounding.
18 fathoms and white sand!
Next time it was 13 fathoms and shells. And then, at last, the cry,
"Land ho!"
Despite his weakness, Mac longed to go on deck. "This is America," he thought. "I've crossed the world to the far side, and I'm still alive. I wish I could see America." That night the Rosebud anchored in calm waters. The seaman who brought the prisoners rations of salt pork and foul water was one of the more friendly crew members. His name was Ezekiel Bell. He was disfigured, he had lost one ear, he was completely bald, and he had a huge goiter like a hen's egg on his neck, and he was ironically known as Beau Bell. He told them they were off Cape Henry, near the town of Hampton in Virginia. Next day the ship remained at anchor. Mac wondered angrily what was prolonging their voyage. Someone must have gone ashore for supplies, because that night there came from the galley a mouth-watering smell of fresh meat roasting. It tortured the prisoners and gave Mac stomach cramps.
"Mac, what happens when we get to Virginia?"
Peg asked.
"We'll be sold and have to work for whoever buys us," he replied.
"Will we be sold together?"
He knew there was little chance of it, but he did not say so.
"We might be," he said. "Let's hope for the best."
There was a silence while Peg took that in. When she spoke again, her voice was frightened.
"Who will buy us?"
"Farmers, planters, housewives, anyone who needs workers and wants them cheap."
"Someone might want all 3 of us.
"Who would want a coal miner and 2 thieves? Mac said,
"Or perhaps we might be bought by people who live close together."
"What work will we do?"
"Anything we're told to, I suppose. Farm work, cleaning, building."
"We'll be just like slaves."
"But only for 7 years.
7 years,
she said dismally.
"I'll be grown up."
"And I'll be almost 30, Mac said. It seemed middle-aged.
"Will they beat us?"
Mac knew that the answer was yes, but he lied.
"Not if we work hard and keep our mouths shut."
"Who gets the money when we're bought?"
"Sir George Jamieson."
The fever had tired him, and he added impatiently,
"I'm sure you've asked me half these damn questions before."
Peg turned away, hurt.
Cora said, "She's worried, Mac. That's why she keeps asking the same questions."
"I'm worried, too," Mac thought wretchedly.
"I don't want to reach Virginia," Peg said. "I want the voyage to go on forever."
Cora laughed bitterly.
"You enjoy living this way?"
"It's like having a mother and father," Peg said.
Cora put her arm around the child and hugged her. They weighed anchor the following morning, and Mac could feel the ship bowling along in front of a strong, favorable wind. In the evening, he learned they were almost at the mouth of the Rappahannock River. Then contrary winds kept them at anchor for 2 wasted days before they could head upriver. Mac's fever abated, and he was strong enough to go up on deck for one of the intermittent exercise periods. And as the ship tacked upriver, he got his first sight of America. Thick woods and cultivated fields lined both banks. At intervals there would be a jetty, a cleared stretch of bank, and a lawn rising up to a grand house. Here and there around the jetties he saw the huge barrels known as hogsheads, used for transporting tobacco. He had watched them being unloaded in the port of London, and it now struck him as remarkable that everyone had survived the hazardous and violent transatlantic journey to get there from here. Most of the people in the fields were black, he noticed. The horses and dogs looked the same as any others, but the birds perching on the ship's rail were unfamiliar. There were lots of other vessels on the river, a few merchantmen like the Rosebud and many smaller craft. That brief survey was all he saw for the next 4 days, but he kept the picture in his mind like a treasured souvenir as he lay in the hold. The sunshine, the people walking around in the fresh air, the woods and the lawns and the houses. The longing he felt to get off the Rosebud and walk around in the open air was so strong it was like a pain. When at last they anchored, he learned they were at Fredericksburg, their destination. The voyage had taken 8 weeks. That night the convicts got cooked food, a broth of fresh pork with Indian corn and potatoes in it, a slab of new bread, and a quart of ale. The unaccustomed rich food and strong ale made Mac feel dizzy and sick all night. Next morning they were brought up on deck in groups of 10, and they saw Fredericksburg. They were anchored in a muddy river with midstream islands. There was a narrow sandy beach, a strip of wooded waterfront, then a short, sharp rise to the town itself, which was built around a bluff. It looked as though a couple of 100 people might live there. It was not much bigger than Hugh, the village where Mac had been born, but it seemed a cheerful, prosperous place, with houses of wood painted white and green. On the opposite bank, a little upstream, was another town, which Mac learned was called Falmouth. The river was crowded, with 2 more ships as big as the Rosebud, several smaller coasters, some flat boats, and a ferry crossing between the 2 towns. Men worked busily all along the waterfront, unloading ships, rolling barrels, and carrying chests in and out of warehouses. The prisoners were given soap and made to wash, and a barber came on board to shave the men and cut their hair. Those whose clothes were so ragged as to be indecent were given replacement garments, but their gratitude was diminished when they recognized them as having been taken from those who had died on the voyage. Mac got Mad Barney's verminous coat. He draped it over a rail and beat it with a stick until no more lice fell out. The captain made a list of the surviving prisoners and asked each what his trade had been at home. Some had been casual laborers or, like Cora and Peg, had never earned an honest living. They were encouraged to exaggerate or invent something. Peg was put down as a dressmaker's apprentice, Cora as a barmaid. Mac realized it was all a belated effort to make them look attractive to buyers. They were returned to the hold, and that afternoon 2 men were brought down to inspect them. They were an odd-looking pair. One wore the red coat of a British soldier over homespun breeches, the other a once-fashionable yellow waistcoat with crudely sewn buckskin trousers. Despite their odd clothes, they looked well-fed and had the red noses of men who could afford all the liquor they wanted. Beau Bell whispered to Mac that they were soul drivers and explained what that meant. They would buy up groups of slaves, convicts, and indentured servants and herd them upcountry like sheep to sell to remote farmers and mountain men. Mac did not like the look of them. They went away without making a purchase. Tomorrow was race day, Bell said. The gentry came into town from all around for the horse races. Most of the convicts would be sold by the end of the day. Then the soul drivers would offer a knockdown price for all those who remained. Mac hoped Cora and Peg did not end up in their hands. That night there was another good meal. Mac ate it slowly and slept soundly. In the morning, everyone was looking a little better. They seemed bright-eyed and able to smile. Throughout the voyage, their only meal had been dinner, but today they got a breakfast of porridge and molasses and a ration of rum and water. Consequently, despite the uncertain future that faced them, it was a cheerful group that mounted the ladder out of the hold and hobbled, still chained, on deck. There was more activity on the waterfront today, with several small boats landing, numerous carts passing along the main street, and small knots of smartly dressed people lounging around, obviously taking a day off. A fat-bellied man in a straw hat came on board, accompanied by a tall, grey-haired Negro. The two of them looked over the convicts, picking out some and rejecting others. Mac soon figured that they were selecting the youngest and strongest men, and inevitably he was among the 14 or 15 chosen. No women or children were picked. When the selection was finished, the captain said, "Right, you lot, go with these men." "Where are we going?" Mac asked. They ignored him. Peg began to cry. Mac embraced her. He had known this was going to happen, and it broke his heart. Every adult Peg trusted had been taken from her. Her mother killed by sickness, her father hanged, and now Mac sold away from her. He hugged her hard and she clung to him.
"Take me with you,"
she wailed. He detached himself from her.
"Try and stay with Cora if you can," he said.
Cora kissed him on the lips with desperate passion. It was hard to believe that he might never see her again, never again lie in bed with her and touch her body and make her gasp with pleasure. Hot tears ran down her face and into his mouth as they kissed.
"Try and find us, Mac, for God's sake," she pleaded.
"I'll do my best.
Promise me,"
she insisted. "I promise I'll find you."
The fat-bellied man said, "Come on, lover boy," and jerked Mac away from her. He looked back over his shoulder as he was pushed down the gangway onto the wharf. Cora and Peg stood watching with their arms around one another, crying. Mac thought of his parting from Esther. "I won't fail Cora and Peg the way I failed Esther," he vowed. Then they were lost from sight. It felt strange to put his feet on solid ground after 8 weeks of having the never-ceasing movement of the sea beneath him. As he hobbled down the unpaved main street in his chains, he stared about him, looking at America. The town centre had a church, a market house, a pillory, and a gallows. Brick and wood houses stood widely spaced along either side of the street. Sheep and chickens foraged in the muddy road. Some buildings seemed old established, but there was a raw, new look to many. The town was thronged with people, horses, carts and carriages, most of which must have come from the countryside all around. The women had new bonnets and ribbons, and the men wore polished boots and clean gloves. Many people's clothes had a homemade look, even though the fabrics were costly. He overheard several people talking of races and betting odds. Virginians seemed keen on gambling. The townspeople looked at the convicts with mild curiosity, the way they might have watched a horse canter along the street, a sight they had seen before, but which continued to interest them. The town petered out after half a mile. They waded across the river at a ford, then set off along a rough track through wooded countryside. Mac put himself next to the middle-aged Negro.
"My name is Malachi Makash," he said. "They call me Mac."
The man kept his eyes straight ahead, but spoke in a friendly enough way.
"I'm Kobe," he said. "Kobe Tambala."
"The fat man in the straw hat, does he own us now?"
"No, Bill Sowerby is just the overseer. Him and me was told to go aboard the Rosebud and pick out the best field hands."
"Who has bought us?"
"You ain't exactly been bought."
"What then?"
"Mr. J. Jamison decided to keep you for himself to work on his own place, Mockjack Hall."
"Jamison?"
"That's right."
Mac was once again owned by the Jamison family. The thought made him angry.
"Damn them to hell. I'll run away again," he vowed. "I will be my own man."
Kobe said,
"What work did you do before?"
"I used to be a coal miner."
"Coal? I've heard tell of it. A rock that burns like wood, but hotter."
"Aye,
Trouble is you have to go deep underground to find it. What about yourself?
My people were farmers in Africa. My father had a big piece of land, more than Mr. Jamison.
Mac was surprised. He had never thought of slaves as coming from rich families.
What kind of farm? Mixed. Wheat, some cattle, but no tobacco. We have a root called the yam grows out there. Never seen it here, though.
You speak English well.
I've been here nearly 40 years.
A look of bitterness came over his face.
I was just a boy when they stole me.
Peg and Cora were on Mac's mind.
There were two people on the ship with me, a woman and a girl, he said. Will I be able to find out who bought them?
Kobe gave a humorless laugh.
Everybody's trying to find someone they were sold apart from. People ask around all the time. When slaves meet up on the road or in the woods, that's all they talk about.
The child's name is Peg, Mac persisted. She's only 13. She doesn't have a mother or father.
When you've been bought, nobody has a mother or father.
Kobe had given up, Mac realized. He had grown accustomed to his slavery and learned to live with it. He was bitter, but he had abandoned all hope of freedom.
I swear I'll never do that, Mac thought.
They walked about 10 miles. It was slow because the convicts were fettered. Some were still chained in pairs. Those whose partners had died on the voyage were hobbled, their ankles chained together so that they could walk but not run. None of them could go fast, and they might have collapsed if they had tried, so weak were they from lying flat for 8 weeks. The overseer, Sowerby, was on horseback, but he seemed in no hurry, and as he rode he sipped some kind of liquor from a flask. The countryside was more like England than Scotland, and not as alien as Mac had anticipated. The road followed the rocky river, which wound through a lush forest. Mac wished he could lie in the shade of those big trees for a while. He wondered how soon he would see the amazing Lizzie. He felt bitter about being the property of a Jamison again, but her presence would be some consolation. Unlike her father-in-law, she was not cruel, though she could be thoughtless. Her unorthodox ways and her vivacious personality delighted Mac, and she had a sense of justice that had saved his life in the past and might do so again. It was noon when they arrived at the Jamison plantation. A path led through an orchard where cattle grazed to a muddy compound with a dozen or so cabins. Two elderly black women were cooking over open fires, and 4 or 5 naked children played in the dirt. The cabins were crudely built with rough-hewn planks, and their shuttered windows had no glass. Sowerby exchanged a few words with Kobe and disappeared. Kobe said to the convicts,
"These are your quarters."
Someone said,
"Do we have to live with the blackies?"
Mac laughed. After 8 weeks in the hellhole of the Rosebud, it was a miracle they could complain about their accommodation.
Kobe said, "White and black live in separate cabins. There's no law about it, but it always seems to work out that way. Each cabin takes 6 people. Before we rest, we have 1 more chore. Follow me."
They walked along a footpath that wound between fields of green wheat, tall Indian corn growing out of hillocks, and the fragrant tobacco plant. Men and women were at work in every field, weeding between the rows and picking grubs off the tobacco leaves. They emerged onto a wide lawn and went up a rise towards a sprawling, dilapidated clapboard house with drab, peeling paint and closed shutters. Mock Jack Hall, presumably. Skirting the house, they came to a group of outbuildings at the back. One of the buildings was a smithy. Working there was a negro whom Kobe addressed as Cass. He began to strike the fetters from the convict's legs. Mac watched as the convicts were unchained one by one. He felt a sense of liberation, though he knew it was false. These chains had been put on him in Newgate Prison, on the far side of the world. He had resented them every minute of the 8 degrading weeks he had worn them. From the high point where the house stood, he could see the glint of the Rappahannock River, about 1/2 mile away, winding through woodland. "When my chains are struck, I could just run away, down to the river," he thought, "and I could jump in and swim across and make a bid for freedom." He would have to restrain himself. He was still so weak that he probably could not run 1/2 mile. Besides, he had promised to search for Peg and Cora, and he would have to find them before he escaped, for he might not be able to afterwards. And he had to plan carefully. He knew nothing of the geography of this land. He needed to know where he was going and how he would get there. All the same, when at last he felt the irons fall from his legs, he had to make an effort not to run away. While he was still fighting the impulse, Kobe began to speak.
Now you've lost your chains. Some of you are already figuring how far you can get by sundown. Before you run away, there's something important you need to know. So listen up and pay attention.
He paused for effect, then went on.
People who run away are generally caught, and they get punished. First, they're flogged, but that's the easy part. Then they have to wear the iron collar, which some find shameful. But the worst is, your time is made longer. If you're away for a week, you have to serve 2 weeks extra. We got people here run away so many times, they won't be free until they're 100 years old.
He looked around and caught Mac's eye.
If you're willing to chance that much, he finished, all I can say is, I wish you luck.
In the morning, the old women cooked a boiled corn dish called hominy for breakfast. The convicts and slaves ate it with their fingers out of wooden bowls. There were about 40 field hands altogether. Apart from the new intake of convicts, most were black slaves. There were 4 indentured servants, people who had sold 4 years' labor in advance to pay for their transatlantic ticket. They kept apart from the others and evidently considered themselves superior. There were only 3 regular waged employees, 2 free blacks and a white woman, all past 50 years old. Some of the blacks spoke good English, but many talked in their own African languages and communicated with the whites in a childish kind of pidgin. At first, Mac was inclined to treat them as children. Then it struck him that they were superior to him in speaking 1.5 languages, for he had only 1. They were marched a mile or 2 across broad fields to where the tobacco was ready to harvest. The tobacco plants stood in neat rows about 3 feet apart and 1/4 mile long. They were about as tall as Mac, each with 12 or so broad green leaves. The hands were given their orders by Bill Sowerby and Kobe. They were divided into 3 groups. The first were given sharp knives and set to cutting down the ripe plants. The next group went into a field that had been cut the previous day. The plants lay on the ground, their big leaves wilted after a day drying in the sun. Newcomers were shown how to split the stalks of the cut plants and spear them on long wooden spikes. Mac was in the 3rd group, which had the job of carrying the loaded spikes across the fields to the tobacco house, where they were hung from the high ceiling to cure in the air. It was a long, hot summer day. The men from the Rosebud were not able to work as hard as the others. Mac found himself constantly overtaken by women and children. He had been weakened by disease, malnutrition, and inactivity. Bill Sowerby carried a whip, but Mac did not see him use it. At noon they got a meal of coarse cornbread that the slaves called pon. While they were eating, Mac was dismayed, but not completely surprised, to see the familiar figure of Sidney Lennox, dressed in new clothes, being shown around the plantation by Sowerby. No doubt Jay felt that Lennox had been useful to him in the past, and might be so again. At sundown, feeling exhausted, they left the fields. But instead of returning to their cabins, they were marched to the tobacco house, now lit up by dozens of candles. After a hasty meal, they worked on, stripping the leaves from cured plants, removing the thick central spine, and pressing the leaves into bundles. As the night wore on, some of the children and older people fell asleep at their work, and an elaborate warning system came into play, whereby the stronger ones covered for the week and woke them when Sowerby approached. It must have been past midnight, Mac guessed, when at last the candles were snuffed and the hands were allowed to return to their cabins and lie down on their wooden bunks. Mac fell asleep immediately. It seemed only seconds later that he was being shaken awake to go back to work. Wearily, he got to his feet and staggered outside. Leaning against the cabin wall, he ate his bowl of hominy. No sooner had he stuffed the last handful into his mouth than they were marched off again. As they entered the field in the dawn light, he saw Lizzie. He had not set eyes on her since the day they boarded the Rosebud. She was on a white horse, crossing the field at a walk. She wore a loose linen dress and a big hat. The sun was about to rise, and there was a clear, watery light. She looked well, rested, comfortable, the lady of the manor riding about her estate. She had put on some weight, Mac noticed, while he had wasted away from starvation. But he could not resent her, for she had stood up for what was right and had thereby saved his life more than once. He recalled the time he had embraced her in the alley off Tyburn Street after he had saved her from the two ruffians. He had held that soft body close to his own and inhaled the fragrance of soap and feminine perspiration. And for a mad moment he had thought that Lizzie, rather than Cora, might be the woman for him. Then sanity had returned. Looking at her rounded body, he realized she was not getting fat. She was pregnant. She would have a son, and he would grow up a Jamison, cruel and greedy and heartless, Mac thought. He would own this plantation and buy human beings and treat them like cattle, and he would be rich. Lizzie caught his eye. He felt guilty that he had been thinking such harsh thoughts of her unborn child. She stared at first, unsure who he was. Then she seemed to recognize him with a jolt. Perhaps she was shocked by the change in his appearance caused by the voyage. He held her eye for a long time, hoping she would come over to him, but then she turned away without speaking and kicked her horse into a trot, and a moment later she disappeared into the woods. End of side 13. Side 14. Chapter 27. A week after arriving at Mockjack Hall, Jay Jamison sat watching two slaves unpack a trunk of glassware. Belle was middle-aged and heavy, and she had ballooning breasts and a vast rear. But Mildred was about 18 years old, with perfect tobacco-coloured skin and lazy eyes. When she reached up to the shelves of the cabinet, he could see her breasts move under the drab homespun shift she wore. His stare made both women uneasy, and they unwrapped the delicate crystal with shaky hands. If they broke anything, they would have to be punished. Jay wondered if he should beat them. The thought made him restless, and he got up and went outside. Mockjack Hall was a big, long-fronted house, with a pillared portico facing down a sloping lawn to the muddy Rappahannock River. Any house of its size in England would have been made of stone or brick, but this was a wood-frame building. It had been painted white with green shutters many years ago, but now the paint was peeling and the colours had faded to a uniform drab. At the back and sides were numerous outhouses containing the kitchen, laundry and stables. The main house had grand reception rooms, drawing room, dining room, and even a ballroom, and spacious bedrooms upstairs, but the whole interior needed redecoration. There was much once fashionable imported furniture and faded silk hangings and worn rugs. The air of lost grandeur about the place was like a smell of drains. Nevertheless, Jay felt good as he surveyed his estate from the portico. It was 1,000 acres of cultivated fields, wooded hillsides, bright streams and broad ponds, with 40 hands and 3 house servants. And the land and the people belonged to him, not to his family, not to his father,